Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On December 1st, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Cargill v. Doe. There were two legal questions before the court. The first was whether the presumption against extraterritorial application of the Alien Tort Statute is displaced by allegations that a U.S. company generally conducted oversight of its foreign operations at its headquarters and made operational and financial decisions there, even though the conduct alleged to violate international law occurred in, and the plaintiff suffered their injuries in, a foreign country. The second question before the court was whether a domestic corporation is subject to liability in a private action under the Alien Tort Statute. David Rebicki is a partner at K&L Gates LLP. He joins us today to discuss this case's oral argument.
That are queued up in our companion cases, Nestle and Cargill today, fall under two main headings, extraterritoriality and liability. The first main question that the court is asking, the court asked today and asked in its previous ATS precedents, is essentially what does it take to overcome the presumption of extraterritoriality that applies to the ATS? And specifically in this case, whether an aiding and abetting claim that is made against a domestic U.S. corporation brought under the ATS can overcome that extraterritoriality bar when the claim is based on allegations of general corporate activity in the United States. So the first main issue is the extraterritorial application of the statute. The second issue is liability itself. And that has to do with whether the judiciary has the authority under the alien, the ATS, to impose liability on domestic corporations. So those are the two main issues, extraterritoriality and liability. And these issues have been explored by the Supreme Court roughly over the last 20 years in a number of salient background cases that left open two main questions. Number one, what is the focus of the ATS, and does the general corporate liability that I just mentioned fall within it? And number two, can domestic corporations be sued? These are questions that are left open, but were addressed today by the court. The first significant precedent is Sosa against Alvarez Machine. It's a 2004 case. Even though the ATS is a jurisdictional statute, the court acknowledged in Sosa that the statute allows courts to provide a cause of action for the modest number of international law violations that I previously addressed, the Blackstone Three, that pose a potential for personal liability at the time of its enactment in the 18th century. Basically, again, piracy, safe conduct, and rights pertaining to ambassadors. Sosa, therefore, was essentially a license for federal courts to develop common law liability rules to redress these purported violations of the law of nations, which is what happened in the Filatiga decision from the Second Circuit. But in Sosa, the court warned that federal courts have to exercise great caution before allowing the ATS claims to move forward, and it therefore created a two-pronged test limiting courts' ability to create new ATS causes of action. The first test asks whether the plaintiff can demonstrate that the alleged violation of international law is a norm that is, quote, specific, universal, and obligatory, like the norms against piracy and safe conduct were at the end of the 18th century, for example. That's prong one. Prong two asks, it assumes that if you've satisfied prong one, would allowing the specific ATS case to proceed be a proper exercise of judicial discretion in light of other concerns like foreign affairs concerns, the province of the political branches, and the separation of powers? In the roughly 15 years since Sosa, The court has never recognized another cause of action under the ATS, even though SOSA declined to completely close the door to further independent judicial recognition of actionable international law norms. SOSA emphasized that the door was still ajar, but subject to, quote, vigilant doorkeeping. So that's SOSA 2004. The court next addresses the ATS in 2013 in the Keobel case, Keobel against Royal Dutch Petroleum Company. And it was in that case that the court expressly held that the presumption against extraterritoriality applies to claims under the ATS. In that case, because all of the relevant conduct took place outside of the U.S., the court did not need to determine what the ATS's specific focus was. But the court noted that claims brought under the statute have to, quote, touch and concern the United States with sufficient force to displace the presumption against extraterritoriality. And the Keobel court expressly held that mere corporate presence is insufficient to touch and concern the United States. The next significant case, next significant precedent is 3 years later in 2016, RJR Nabisco against European Community. It's not an ATS case. It's a civil RICO case. But it's significant for our analysis today because it sets forth another two-part test involving how the court looks to analyze the extraterritoriality or not of a statute. Basically, the court in RJR looks at the claims that its civil RICO plaintiffs brought and held that there has to that civil RICO plaintiffs have to allege sufficient domestic conduct as the focus of the RICO statute to displace the presumption against extraterritoriality, and have to also allege and prove a domestic injury. They set forth a two-step framework for this analysis. At step one under RJR, the court asks whether the presumption has been rebutted. That is basically whether Congress has given an affirmative indication that the statute applies extraterritorially. If Congress hasn't done that, then at step two, the court has to ask whether the case involves a domestic application of the statute by considering the statute's focus. And to consider the focus of the statute, the court has to look to what the statute was essentially aimed to regulate, the persons and the interests. In other words, that the statute seeks to protect. In our cases, in the Nestle and Cargill consolidated cases, the litigants essentially pose the touch and concern tests and the focus tests as competing analytical frameworks, but they're not really that at all. RJR clarifies essentially what touch and concern means. And there's no special extraterritorial test for the ATS. Which is why RJR is relevant to our analysis, even though it's not an ATS case. The final and perhaps most significant precedent for today's cases is Jessner against Arab Bank, a 2018 case with a number of concurrent opinions and fractured holdings, but one in which five justices, Kennedy, Roberts, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, agreed that foreign corporations were not subjected to the to ATS liability. The petitioners in that case were relatives of the victims of terrorist attacks in Israel, West Bank, and elsewhere. And they sued a Jordanian-based bank, Arab Bank, claiming that it facilitated the terrorist acts by using its correspondent account in the United States to process dollar-denominated transactions, to launder money, et cetera, et cetera. And Jessner is especially significant, as I said, because the court declined to extend ATS liability to foreign corporations, stating that there is no specific, universal, and obligatory international law norm of corporate liability, a holding which has obvious import for our consolidated cases. In Justice Kennedy's plurality opinion, he stated that Congress was in a better position to consider if the public interest would be served by imposing new forms of substantive legal liability against foreign corporations. Justice Kennedy found that the separation of powers concerns militated against creating that liability because obviously if foreign corporations are subjected to ATS jurisdiction, there are obvious U.S. foreign policy and foreign affairs consequences to that kind of decision. The nation of Jordan in that case actually submitted a brief stating that the suit against Arab Bank was a grave affront to Jordan's sovereignty. Jessner is also significant insofar as that Justices Kennedy, Roberts, and Thomas all agreed in a concurring opinion that all corporations, not just foreign corporations, should be exempt from ATS jurisdiction in applying the SOSA two-part test. And Justice Alito in a separate concurrence said that based on separation of powers concerns, the judiciary should not create new causes of action. So those are the precedents that animate the arguments that we heard today. Briefly, the facts involve plaintiffs and respondents today who are citizens of Mali and allege that they were, as children, trafficked by labor traffickers who sold them to cocoa farms in Cote d'Ivoire, the country of Cote d'Ivoire, forcing them to work there. All of their injuries ended at the latest in 2001. The plaintiffs didn't sue the labor traffickers or the farmers and instead alleged that both Nestle USA and Cargill aided and abetted the human rights abuses that they suffered by purchasing cocoa from the farms, despite knowing or at least recklessly not knowing, they should have known, essentially, about the widespread use of child labor in those West African countries. Essentially, the petitioners, Nestle and Cargill, state that the allegations do not amount to a domestic application of the ATS and therefore cannot be permitted under the statute. And their argument essentially is that the ATS's focus is on the location of the alleged tortious conduct that violates international law. And that general principles of extraterritoriality support that domestic injury requirement. They argue that the court should, in this case, draw a bright line domestic injury rule. And that's particularly significant in the context of aiding and abetting allegations, which by their nature must focus on the principal underlying conduct, the principal underlying tort. Essentially, petitioners argue that there's really no minimum contacts to the United States sufficient to create ATS jurisdiction. The only allegations that the plaintiffs make are that the companies do business in the U.S. and they have a corporate presence here and made high-level corporate decisions here, not that they knew that the specific farms from which their cocoa originated were hosted child labor. Plaintiffs don't even actually allege that cocoa was purchased from those specific farms. And we can go into the issue of the pleading issues involving the case later. But essentially, the nature of the allegations, the aiding and abetting liability that plaintiffs allege, would basically apply to any U.S.-based corporation that has a supply chain with any international links, given the facts of this case, which essentially amount to nothing more than generalized corporate presence in the United States. So the first issue, extraterritoriality, the petitioners say there's no domestic application of the ATS because all of the tortious injuries that plaintiffs allegedly suffered happened abroad. The second issue, as I said earlier, liability, is one that petitioners say should not exist under the ATS for domestic corporations. And they point to Jessner, which is strong precedent in this vein, because the court already observed in that case that there's no specific universal norm against international corporate liability for foreign corporations, and essentially petitioners import the same separation of powers and foreign affairs policy arguments from that case to say that those arguments should apply and do apply with equal force to domestic U.S. corporations. So Jessner's rationale applies equally to those domestic corporations, and had Congress wished to extend ATS liability to domestic corporations, it could have done so. Congress is familiar with the ATS and has actually legislated an ATS cause of action in a statute called the Torture Victim Protection Act, in which Congress did not create a cause of action for corporate liability. And petitioners argue that Jessner and Congress's action in the TVPA legislation should really be dispositive here, and that creating a cause of action should be left to them. If the judiciary, on the other hand, were to create a cause of action, essentially reactivating a pre-Erie style federal common law, if they were to create a new cause of action that would impermissibly intrude on the field of foreign affairs, which is the province of the political branches, not the judiciary. The petitioners observe that were the court to rule as they've asked, this wouldn't by any means end ATS liability. It would simply require the plaintiffs to sue the actual tortfeasors, the labor traffickers and cocoa farmers in West Africa, where the farms were located. That, in a nutshell, is the petitioner's case. The respondents argue, in contrast, that there are obvious and clear international norms prohibiting child slavery, forced labor, and trafficking, which meet the historical paradigm standard set forth in SOSA Step 1. Their brief is, however, pretty short on evidence to support that claim, but it was noteworthy at the oral argument today that Anil Katyal, who argued on behalf of the of Nestle and Cargill, essentially conceded that child slavery was an international norm under SOSA Step 1. So in many ways, that issue that was briefed quite extensively, was mooted at the oral argument today. The respondents, plaintiffs Doe's, also argue that the separation of powers concerns and the foreign policy potential for foreign policy complications are entirely speculative under SOSA Step 2, and the court needn't worry itself about those issues because the issues that pertain to foreign corporations just simply aren't present in the domestic context. And Chief Justice Roberts actually asked both Mr. Katyal and Curtis Gannon, who argued for the United States at this morning's oral argument, why it is that the court should be concerned about those prudential matters, because you're dealing with U.S. corporations being sued in the United States for violations of international law. So the Chief Justice asked, why should it be that foreign sovereigns would be troubled by a proceeding like that? And I think both the government and petitioners responded well, pointing out that essentially, if you're allowed to sue a domestic corporation, and in this case, on the facts of this case, Nestle USA is a wholly owned subsidiary of a Swiss parent, you still have foreign implications, and you're essentially allowing litigants an end run around Jessner, who can now say, "Well, I'm not going to sue the foreign corporation. I'll just sue the wholly owned U.S. subsidiary." So there's a surrogacy issue there that is still present if litigants are allowed to sue U.S. corporations, although under Jessner they can't sue the foreign parent. The respondents also argue that creating a forum for foreign nationals to seek redress of alleged violations of customary international law against U.S. corporations in U.S. court actually advances U.S. foreign policy. And so there is no friction there between what the political branches could do in legislating. The courts, according to respondents, have a role in resolving these international disputes. And the first Congress and the early Republic realized this and, according to respondents, decided to give courts a role in the resolution of these diplomatic conflicts. So the petitioners hit also on the extraterritoriality issue and the liability issues, the two main headings that I mentioned at the beginning of the call. As I said, with respect to the extraterritoriality question and the focus of the statute, I think that the petitioner's brief is rather thin on evidence from the time of the passage of the ATS that Congress actually intended the statute to apply to violations of international law, customary international law by U.S. citizens anywhere in the world. The cases that we know concern Congress all involved conduct in the United States, and the cases that the Does point to don't really refute that. There's one case that's mainly a piracy case, and then other cases involving slave ships or the East India Company, which the plaintiffs use to argue that not only extraterritoriality was envisioned, but that corporate liability was a norm at the time of the passage of the ATS, which also is, I think, a difficult argument to make on the evidence. There's also the issue of two statutes that I, one of which I previously mentioned, the TVPA, the Torture Victim Protection Act, in which Congress expressly created a new cause of action on the ATS, but did not allow suits against corporations. In a subsequent enactment, the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, the TVPRA, Congress did expressly allow for extraterritorial application of the TVPRA and did, in fact, allow suits against corporate entities under certain circumstances. And today's oral argument was significant in this respect because petitioners essentially conceded that had the TVPRA been enacted at the time that they filed their complaint back in 2004, they would have never used the ATS in the first instance. And so I found that to be significant because at least it indicated to me an implicit admission that they're trying to fit the square peg into the round hole through the ATS. And the admission also implicitly shows that one of petitioners' arguments is correct, namely that if Congress chooses through legislation to create new causes of action or statutes that allow extraterritorial application and jurisdiction over corporations, Congress knows how to do that and can do that and has done that with respect to the subject matter, victim trafficking and such. So I thought that was a really remarkable statement at the oral argument today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.